Hello, everyone, and welcome to Changing the Frame. We are your hosts. My name is Leo Torre, and I use he, they pronouns.
My name is Indigo Corris, and I use she, her pronouns. We're a podcast that discusses trends and non-binary experiences in the film industries. Every episode will count with the appearance of trends and or non-binary multimedia artists in the film industries to talk about their work. We're really excited to share these amazing talks and discussions with you all.
Today, we have an incredible guest, Lyle Rabi Cash, who is a filmmaker and interdisciplinary practitioner who makes films with trans people about trans people. Cash's debut film, Death and Bowling, had an extensive festival run, garnering awards from Outfest, Newfest, Les Gay Cine Madrid, and Lovers Film Festival in Torino, Italy. Autostrado called the film a fantasia on death and creation, stating that this is what we should be yearning for. Cash recently worked with the New York City Ballet, and he is producing Angelo Matson Minax's A Body to Live In.
This is Changing the Frame.
Hello, hello, Lyle. Thank you so much for joining us today and discussing about your film, which is fantastic and almost literally made me cry. So I was just wondering if you could tell us a little bit about yourself and your background, hobbies, and other practice that you're interested in.
So I'm Lyle Cash. I use he, him, and I'm a queer and trans filmmaker. I live on the East Coast of the United States. I'm a dog dad. I love watching films and making films and spending time outside.
That's so lovely. We were wondering what made you pursue filmmaking because we read that you dreamed of pursuing a legal career beforehand, and we're wondering about the shift in careers and what kind of roadblocks you faced when you started filmmaking as well.
Well, I come from a family of many lawyers, and so I have a little bit of an argumentative streak. Maybe a controlling streak. These things are suited for directing as well. But I just like could not fucking imagine putting on a suit and going into a courtroom every day. I guess there are lots of different types of lawyers, but it seemed like a totally miserable life. My intentions as a possible attorney were to support social justice movements and act as like a wing for leftist movement building. However, I didn't see a lot of work being done in the US from an attorney standpoint that didn't result in like total burnout or just like disconnection from reality. And I also wanted to live my life, and I'm a creative person. So I see that was just not the right position for me, though. Working with movement building organizations led me to filmmaking because guess what? Another type of movement building support is media literacy and media support. So it was an easy path. And I think a lot of leftist movement building efforts are about, imagining a different world that doesn't exist yet. And there's a very similar relationship to storytelling and creating a film. And so they feel like, linked together.
For sure. And how did you come up with the idea for this film when talking about filmmaking, and what inspired Death and Bowling?
You know, some kind of crazy storm of things inspired Death and Bowling. I'm not a bowler. I don't care for bowling. It's embarrassing and I'm terrible at it. But, I wanted to make a film about grief, and I wanted to really stray away from fictional trans filmmaking that is like nearly so hyper real or has the goal of portraying such, we've heard like accurate representation, blah, 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 that I wanted to just be, I was not interested in making a documentary, and I was not interested in making a documentary through fiction. So I wanted to deal with themes and images that were not entirely mine, though the story is extremely intimate and close to me. Mm-hmm. The backdrop of bowling really came about because it captured this theme of like grief, American pastime. And I say grief because I think it's like, it's a dying cultural space. It's one that's full of nostalgia in the States. It captures the generation that I portrayed on The Lavender League, but it's also a site of like aesthetic nostalgia for millennials. And it also captures like, you know, that's a space you can shoot in and rationalize why you have such a, like, nostalgic images, because it's also calling up like a generation of queer filmmaking. So that's the backdrop. That's how that came to be. And then the story, I think, is just like hodgepodge of personal experiences, like, you know, me painting with a broad brush, like trying to come up with some like trans aesthetic themes and, you know, poetics and blah, blah, blah.
That's very good. Speaking about style, especially as well, we were really into the film because it plays a lot into the abstraction. And we thought that there was like many shots that were very dreamlike, very like made up in the mind kind of situation, especially when like they're both in the mountains and they have like the boxing gloves on and everything. That felt like out of a dream instead of like real reality. And how you speak about how you could have made a documentary, but you chose this instead. Is there any other forms of storytelling that you consider for this? Or like, why did you come about with these incredible shots and style for the film?
Some of it is like first time filmmaker paying homage to all the films that I like. And then, you know, eventually you have to pick a genre, like maybe in the editing room. Seriously. But, you know, there were times where this film was like a little bit more of a horror film, where the emotional drama between the two main characters was a little bit more like, yeah, like holy, like moly, like, you know, not feeling so. I think it leaned more towards a romance as the project developed. But, you know, truly the feel and tone came about somewhat organically and by like beginner's luck and through also like mistakes that I made and just organic, yeah, attractions to certain types of cinema, especially like, you know, 1970s, 1980s European art house cinema. But, you know, that scene that you're talking about with the boxing gloves, some of that also, it feels like a dream because it's like, that's like a hot fantasy to me. So I incorporated that and let it be the case that it either happened or it didn't, but sort of who cares.
You mentioned a bit about the wanting to talk about death, and grief is something that we see a lot in the trans community. And death in bowling mostly focuses around death of a beloved character and what it means for everyone around her. However, this portrayal of grief is very positive. How did you develop that idea and put it into the film to talk about it in a positive way as well? Because we see so many films around trans people that are just really, really bad when it relates to death. So, yeah.
Yeah, and even if we've experienced a ton of that in our own lives, it's like, I, for one, do not want to enter a cinema and like feel sad with a bunch of cis people about trans people dying. I'd rather like shave my eyebrows, you know. So however, you know, like what you know, we, a lot of films, not just trans films, are also about grief and death, and the best films that are about grief and death do it in the form of a comedy, or they do it in the form of a horror film. You don't make a tragedy about grief and death because it's just a single note and like super flat. And I think that when we're talking about like authentic representation and visibility, sometimes like that gets confused with like, we need to portray what actually happens in our lives, which like the honest piece is that that involves a lot of grief and death. That's like part of the human experience. And I think this possibility that trans artists can make something that's actually fictional, or that we can begin to actually make art that's about transness, allows us to take different forms to approach these themes. So I wanted to sort of like play the flute slightly differently, but sing the same song. And so that's, I think, what Death and Bowling is. Also, you know, I really wanted to explore this idea that, and it's a controversial one, that suicide is a type of self-determination. It's a choice that a person makes. And I think that there are better choices. I wish that everybody had mental health care and family support, and, you know, that the state had gave a shit about trans people at all. However, we deal with this topic as though it is like anathema to a self-determination politic. And so when X is addressing the fact that his friend or his mother figure, or however you want to understand Susan X's relationship, he says like, he basically, he feels that he can't intervene because he's trans and he's made his own decisions about his body. And so I wanted to take a sort of like trans politic and present death in this way that, you know, just ask that question.
That's so interesting.
Yeah. In talking about like X's experiences of like what happened and like the death around him and everything, we realized that the color palette in the film has a big role in how X explores all of these feelings, because the film begins with X wearing like darker colors and the leather jacket and everything, and by the end of it he's still wearing the leather jacket, but he's wearing the lilac pastel and lilac yellow t-shirt underneath. And we're like discussing this in the sense of like he comes into his own by incorporating his mother figure as well. Is there any like specific decisions that you made with the colors in the filmmaking?
Well, I definitely wanted lilac or purple to be a motif, kind of in the way that I was speaking about the bowling alley. Purple has had such an important history to queer and trans lives over a long period, and I wanted to tie some kind of color palette to the two generations that were portrayed in the film. Also, he goes from wearing this leather jacket, which is sort of like a shell, like a protective armor, and it's not that he loses it, but I think like he allows himself like a little bit of color to seep into his life, and that purple throughout the film is just a callback to Susan. Like the purple screen comes up whenever she's present, whether she's dead or alive, and you know, she's the captain of this bowling league, this Lavender League bowling league, and so he finally dons the shirt because I think he experiences a sense of community by like letting go, essentially.
Honestly, the color palette was incredible.
Yeah.
Thank you.
It was very good.
Awesome.
When talking about death and bowling, do you feel like it's helped you explore your identity deeper in any way whilst in the process of making the film?
You know, that's such a hard one because it's also like a film takes, I've been working on it for like 4 or 5 years now, and it's finally spreading its wings and getting out in the world. So it's like, I'm sure since it was such an important part of those 5 years, and you know, I'm 31 and not 26, so let's all keep our fingers crossed that I like developed and matured in some way, like life experience overall. But, you know, so much of how a filmmaker is changed by a film happens, you know, not just in the life of the film that's on screen, but especially with such a community-driven project like this, I can say for sure that, you know, I didn't know any of the people I was going to work with prior to the film. And there are so many artists in my life now and, you know, actors who I now have like long-term friendships. So yeah, my life was hugely changed, and the way that I think about myself has shifted, you know, as I'm exploring this and talking out loud. I think, yeah, through those relationships, also by bringing on a very intergenerational cast and crew. Yeah, there's something really healing about doing that and being able to like spend time with Tracy Kowalski, who is a different generation than me, and to imagine myself as a like gay trans adult at his age is really nice, because there are not so many people in my life who are of that generation. So I'm sure that in a long-term way that will have like hugely healing, sweet effects on my little heart, you know.
for sure. And see how you speak about like having an intergenerational cast, and like there was such a wide a range of faces and people, and Indigo and I were watching the film together, and we were like, I can't believe we're like actually looking at this, like we could see ourselves represented all through the film in like different ways and see people that we know, kind of like it felt like coming home, and the sense of community is really strong from that. Could you talk a little bit about how you casted an entirely almost trans cast?
Well, oh my god, I love your question, because okay, here's the sort of boring procedural part, which is like, I made some posts on social media and I was like, help, we're doing this, everybody contact me, you know, and a lot of people did. And yeah, you know, we couldn't even work with everybody who wanted to work on the project. So that's aww, sort of incredible and beautiful, although sad for the people who couldn't work with it, but come on board for a future project. But then the other piece, you know, a lot of times cis people ask this question, like, you know, why did the cast need to be all trans, or like, how did you make this decision, or da da da, which is a very different question than, I mean, you've answered the question, which is that watching the film, you feel like you see people in your lives and it feels like coming home. Mm-hmm. Well, yeah. You know, like, I wanted to spend the entire fall with a bunch of trans people, so I hired them. So, you know, like, some of it is like, some of it is like some kind of political position, like, yeah, it's good, it's good, you gotta see trans people, it's great. And the other piece is like, why would I want to make a film differently?
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. So good.
And that piece that feels surreal, I think, to certain trans audiences who have never been in a room with mainly trans people, or have never seen a reality in which, like, there's a range of gender performance and it's difficult to predict how people identify, and that's beautiful, and you're just around trans people and it's magical. Great. If you've never seen that, that can feel like the most fictional sci-fi piece of the film. And for me, it's the only part that's documentarian.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Very much agreed with that. Because it was just like, even when you watch a film about trans people and everything, this just felt so natural to me, because both Indigo and I move in like really queer circles already. So it was like, oh my God, nobody here is cis. This is fantastic.
Yeah.
Also, like, about how you mentioned wanting to like partake in leftist politics and everything. Like, I feel like this film really portrays that as well. And one of the scenes that really marked that for me was the funeral scene when they're all talking. How did you write that?
Oh man. Okay, well, here's an embarrassing departure from our leftist politics discussion. So okay. I mean, I hesitate to say that this is a leftist film in any way. And the reason for that is it was community funded. Half the reason we couldn't work with some of the people who wanted to work with us is we had no flipping money. So if you're not paying someone a living wage, I'm sort of like, fine. Mm-hmm. It's a community project. I get that there's arguments to be made for like why it's still beautiful that it happened. But I'm always like, oh God, we can't call it leftist or feminist or anything, because I just couldn't afford it, which I know is a little bit of an oxymoron. But that aside, that funeral scene actually happened, you know, who knows how I wrote it. Maybe it is some sort of like impulse from like being in community and having, yeah, everyone wants to, it's important to have everyone have a voice and blah, blah, blah. But we were going to shoot that scene in a much more standard way, like in an Italian restaurant. And it was going to be more like, you know, family dinner style, and there's lots of spaghetti. And not that this is like a standard funeral, and who knows how I wrote that either, but we lost the location because we didn't know that it had a second owner, and that person like had a total sort of transphobic freak out, and we lost our contract and were like kicked out for the day. So we lost like 2 days of shooting and ended up doing it in the backyard of our Airbnb. So part of the feeling of it, which I think is so beautiful that on screen it reads to you as some like leftist gathering, but it was like, okay, everybody, we're doing this in one shot, everybody go, you know. So it's a little like run and gun.
I feel like even though it's like community funded, and like I feel like that can still read very leftist, because like this has been built by trans people for trans people, you know, and that really reads to me as like you care about the community, you're doing things for the community. That's just very leftist to me. So you're all good in that sense.
It is, but I think we all have to sort of contend with this issue of like,
yeah, for sure,
trans professionals being able to work in these types of sets that are funded. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, you know, sure. It's both, but thank you for saying that.
It really is both. Yeah,
in terms of trans filmmakers making their films and stuff, in what ways do you think it's harder for minority identities to tell their own stories through filmmaking?
Whew, yeah. Well, I'll speak, you know, from the position of a trans filmmaker, and I think fundamentally, films require an audience, and they are a part of an industry, even if you make them on a shoestring budget. If you want them to get seen in our current environment, right, you have to make them, there's a market involved, and blah, blah, blah. And in that market, I think legibility is like currency for trans films. So unless you have someone who is like prepubescent in some trans way that's unreadable, or they're currently transitioning, or they chose not to transition so that a cis audience can see very clearly in their minds what their birth sex is. You're not, for an audience, making a trans film unless you say over and over from an, you know, in the case of my film, at some point you needed to learn that the two protagonists were trans men, or the film makes no sense. Like, their relations make no sense. It's impossible to read the film from a cis perspective. And there were things that came up around portraying trans characters who were not having a coming of age moment, but who were settled into their transness and living adult lives, like, after the coming of age moment, which is most of our lives, that I had to really make decisions. Like, I would have preferred to never use the word trans throughout the entire film and just have the film be presented in this way. But I mean, you know how I did it. There were compromises that had to be made. But, you know, there were even, like, I had experiences with other trans artists who were saying things like, you know, you should choose this shot because you could tell that he's trans, and I think the film won't really read in this way. And I get exactly what they mean, and maybe that would have been a good decision. And here's where the sticking point comes for, as you describe, minority filmmakers, or I think just, like, yeah, subcultural filmmakers, or filmmakers making work about, yeah, non-normativity, whatever it is. Filmmakers who are making work that's not about white people or rich people. And then if it's not about those things, it's not being told from this sort of, like, ethnographical perspective. So when you're making work about your own community, we have a way of seeing this film that's very quick and easy. And without those cultural reference points, even with as many signposts as I put in this film, which felt sometimes like I was, like, waving a fucking trans flag and being like, everybody, it's a trans film. Okay, with that, you know, I screened the film in Italy last week to, like, total blank stares. Nobody knew. And at the end of the film, like, there were questions like, whose mom was who? And, like, what, you know, and unless you spell out certain things to a non-trans audience, they continue in 2022 to not get it. And it's not the audience's fault, but where, if you're making it for a trans audience, it's possible it'll never be seen in the world ever. So I would say that's the, like, core problem. And if you delve into fiction, holy shit. I mean, it's a, you're already in a world that's, like, difficult to understand, and then you're adding your own fictional rules from your fictional universe that's already trans. I think it's just, we really need to be fighting for this fictional space, because that's where the sort of freedom of filmmaking is happening for a non-normative filmmaker who's making work about their own community. And I think that gets missed sometimes.
What impact do you want your films to have then? Like, from now on, not with just this one, but, like, from now on, what do you think are you trying to achieve for both, like, the trans community and in general?
I would love to be sharing, like, what I feel is beautiful about transness and how, you know, I see the world. I think that's always part of a goal of a filmmaker, whether it's, like, completely egotistical or not. On some level, you're sharing some kind of internal world or an imaginative world. And I, because I see so little of that, or I saw so little of that as a young person, I would really love to contribute to sort of, like, our generation's trans aesthetics and fashion and, like, the imagery we use, and to be part of, like, an artistic dialogue where, like, something from my film ends up in a poster and someone does a painting and there's, like, conversation, or, you know, we're also, I would love to be participating in, like, referencing filmmakers or artists who came from the past. Like, I saw a film recently with a house on fire, and I was like, okay, is this David Wojnarowicz? And they had no idea what that was. So, like, how can we bring back the artists from previous generations in our own work to continue a sort of, like, ancestry of queer art that's in conversation also with dead people? That would be incredible. And also, I would love to make a film that's, like, hot, like, that's sexy with trans men in it. Do you know what I mean? They're just, it doesn't exist very much. It's typically not hot. You know, you be the judge about Death and Bowling, but I would like to push my work in that direction in future projects.
That's so good to hear. I would love to watch more of your film, so.
Great. Okay. Help me find producers. Okay.
And talking about T4T relationships, I know you formed T4T Productions. And I was just wondering if you could tell us a little bit about it. How did you come up with the idea to form it? And also, coming up with a different question, how accessible do you find funding opportunities for trans projects specifically?
So I formed T4T Productions. For listeners who don't know, T4T, at least in my knowledge base, came from old Craigslist ads where, you know, people would be like, M for M. It was like, oh man, looking for a man to have sex with. But T4T obviously was trans for trans and blah, blah. That has now disappeared. I'm not the only trans artist using T4T in my, you know, footnotes, production note, my name of my company, blah, blah, blah. It's widespread. I think like everyone on the planet now has some kind of T4T tattoo, usually on their chest. Who knows? We all have one. Okay, T4T. Okay. So it seems like a sort of obvious choice for, you know, a trans love story. And also a trans love story that's not really between two people, but is a community, and the film was trans and it was for trans people. Okay, we got that piece. In terms of trans funding, I think people want to fund basically, like I said, like documentaries. And if it's not a documentary, they want a fictional documentary that does the same work. And that's because I think we're in a stage where like trans media is supposed to still be like educating. And yeah, that feels a little sad to me, because I think a lot of the work that gets funded ends up sort of playing like a workplace discrimination video, where the plot of the film is one by one, like how to not offend a trans person or trans people accessing healthcare. And it ends up being this sort of like episodic, yeah, like training video that I don't connect to myself. I think there's a lot of work now not being made in that type of format, but you'll see that it's almost entirely funded by communities on Kickstarter, private investors, because some lucky son of a gun found a rich person, or, you know, in a third case scenario, it's in genre. So I think there is money for genre filmmaking, like horror, blah, blah, blah. If you're not working in those capacities, I have literally no idea how to fund my second project. So big, big question mark, you know?
Yeah, because most people that we've been talking to, they're all like independent filmmakers. Yeah, so I wanted to ask that question because you're also in the US, which is a different country. Like, we've been talking mostly with people from the UK, and it seems like it's the same sort of process in the US.
The same struggle, yeah.
Yeah, it is, I would suspect. I mean, is there state funding for independent film? Like, can you apply for state a little bit?
Yeah. I mean, we live in Scotland. Creative Scotland does fund a lot of independent projects, but it can be hard sometimes depending on the project.
Yeah, there's many hoops to go through and like applying and, you know, that whole faff. But yeah.
You know, I was just at like an industry event, blah, 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 and there were a bunch of distributors speaking about, you know, how to, from a pre-production standpoint, do you set up a queer film to get funding and the... And everything they were talking about, they were like having this nostalgia about filmmakers like Todd Haynes and Rainer Werner Fassbinder and Greg Araki and blah, blah, blah. And we don't see any of those equivalent filmmakers of our generation getting the funding, because they would be, those filmmakers today would be completely unsellable. They're sellable now because they're names and there's nostalgia for them. But that kind of work, that kind of like auteur, queer, blah, 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 work is not getting funded. So I think actually we need to sort of like put all of our heads together and decide, how are we going to seek like new models in this moment where that is absolutely not marketable and the only things that are getting funded are marketable, or they're like sob stories, you know? So I think there has to be a third option.
Do you think you could speak about any new projects in the horizon for you?
Yes. Yeah, I'm in brief, you know, I'm making a film, I'm writing a screenplay right now that's sort of like a trans take on the, you know, the story of Pinocchio, not the Disney story of Pinocchio, but as we were finishing up Death and Bowling, a number of collaborators saw the opening scene, and there's a moment where X is in his casting tapes and he's being told to repeat over and over these lines. He said, "I'm a real boy." And we were like, holy shit, it's Pinocchio. Also, like, why has no one ever made a trans Pinocchio story? So it'll be a totally, you know, nothing like Pinocchio, but a wooden trans man will come alive for sure.
Talk about Pinocchio. There is this two trans artists in Scotland who did a play and is a take on trans Pinocchio as well. I think you should check it out. It's by Ivor and Rosanna.
Oh, I would love to.
Ivor McCaskill and Rosanna Cade. And we talked to them a few weeks ago, and honestly, definitely check it out. I think they're going to tour it next month or in a couple months, but yeah.
Oh my God. Well, please put us in touch also after.
I will, don't worry. But that's so exciting.
The second you said Pinocchio, like, my mouth dropped because we were like interviewing them like 2 weeks ago, and it was so
and
good.
And honestly, the line of "I'm a real boy," like, it, yeah, it's so trans, you know, like,
it's so trans.
Sorry, I went on a tangent, but yeah. Okay, so what advice would you share for trans and non-binary creators that are just getting started right now, that being in the US specifically or worldwide?
I think my advice is to not worry so much about this funding piece as like a creative barrier. And I was given really good advice at some point making Death and Bowling, which was like, even though you're self-producing, you have to take your producer hat off and not think about the budget or how you will solve these budget issues. Because otherwise, as you're writing and you write the big car explosion scene or whatever you're writing, you don't need to like hamper the story by in that moment as you're writing, be like, we're never going to be able to afford the, you know, the special effects for this explosion and the stunt guy and the car and blah, blah. You probably can't, but write the story anyway, because I think so many filmmakers get really weighed down. And this is also part of why great fiction is not made, because allowing yourself that imaginative space as though you have the biggest budget on the planet, fix it later when you're having your producer hat on. You can bring someone in and be like, yeah, we can't do the car scene, but what about the core story still exists? Like, how can I create that at the budget level that's actually possible? But don't do it in the beginning. Just write some incredible imaginative story.
I know you mentioned producing and writing and directing. So I just came up with a question in my head right now. So many trans filmmakers that I know are usually the heads of many departments in the process of production. How do you find that, and how do you find tipping your toes in the different departments during the production of your film?
Well, I had never really made a film prior to Death and Bowling. I didn't do the like shorts to feature route. I just made the film. And so my experience previously had been on, you know, much, much smaller sets. And on much smaller sets, everybody's doing everything. So some of what happened with my film is like I just filled in everywhere that, like, where we were springing leaks from the ship, I like stuck my fingers in the holes. You know, it just was like instinct, like, oh, this email needs to get sent. Da, da, da. And that ends up being producing, unless you have like a robust production team that you're paying full time, which was not, you know, Ariel and I's situation. We were both like making other work and had jobs and blah, blah, blah. You end up just doing everything. And so on a larger production, that would be like the work of 15 people. And on our size production, it wasn't. So the answer is kind of like I've at least learned completely as I went along. And in a cool way, that's translated to being able to like do paid work now on other sets, because I have the experience of just having to throw myself into a feature. But I think also, you know, the art of producing is something that a lot of smaller trans productions in the US lack, because no one can afford a professional producer. And it is an art. It's not just something like administrative. And I think, you know, like when we were speaking about filmmakers from eras past, or like, you know, Todd Haynes had this type of relationship with Christine Vachon. Like, where are the Christine Vachons of our generation? Because at this point, it seems like they're not being supported and don't exist. And if they are creative, they're directors. And if they're not, it's almost like a lot of the sort of like idea of what producing is like finding money in it and doing administrative work. But actually, like, those amazing auteur filmmakers existed because producers sought them out and were like, I am going to make it possible for this filmmaker to make this film. And I just don't encounter that anymore. So although it's beautiful that we're able to like fill in the gaps and do all this work on the production end, I think we really need to, I really admire the support of like organizations like Film Independent that have like producer labs, so that it's a specific role. It actually shouldn't be something that just gets like mushy blended in with everybody else's job.
We're almost done, so we were just gonna ask you if you have any other media, so either like films, books, podcasts that you would like to recommend that have like either inspired you or you're really enjoying right now.
I mean, I loved Detransition Baby this year. That I read that and felt it was truly exceptional. Right now, I'm producing a film for my friend and collaborator, Angelo Madsen Minax, and I think all of his filmmaking work is really incredible, and sort of, you know, a lot of his work bridges the gap between narrative and documentary, and so does this really interesting thing that we've been speaking about that I think is really important for trans cinema. His work also like totally kind of avoids like a huge focus on trans identity, but it's all very trans to me. Ariel Mahler is at AFI right now and is making incredible films that none of you can see, but I'm sure that when they graduate, they'll make incredible films that you can all see. So keep an eye on their work. shoot, I should have prepared more for this one, but yeah, everybody's out there. Use Google.
You can send us some recommendations later as well, and we can share them on our social media. Where can people find you and your work?
So, you know, Death and Bowling got distribution from Wolf Releasing this year. So at some point before the end of the year, they will release the film. And so, you know, checking out Wolf's library of LGBT films is a good way to find Death and Bowling at some point, because it'll be there and you can watch it. And aside from that, you know, I have a website that I update every like 4 months, but you know, the pace of like work coming out as a filmmaker is slow enough that it's pretty much up to date. So yeah, this film, A Body to Live In, that I'm producing, I'm sure I'll share some information about how to see that. Also, Wood, my, you know, trans Pinocchio film, there will eventually be information. And I'm on Instagram, so at Queerel, which is like the Fassbinder film Querel, but with an extra E, so it's Q-U-E-E-R-E-L-L-E. And yeah, usually put stuff on there too.
Amazing. Thank you so much. Honestly, it's been a pleasure to talk to you today.
Aw, yeah, a huge pleasure for me as well. Thank you.
Thank you so much for letting us watch the film as well. It was a very enjoyable time, and I think I speak for both Indigo and I saying that we're definitely going to watch it again soon, because I really enjoyed it, and I think you're doing fantastic work, so keep it up.
Thank you. It means a lot.
This conversation has been incredible. We just want to thank Lyle so much for joining us today. It's been a pleasure.
Make sure to follow Lyle on social media to get updates on Death and Bowling screenings and other work that he's working on.
Thank you so much for listening to this amazing episode, and stay tuned for our following episode next month.